From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a
big
butthole. It's been a very big week at the Supreme Court, and gay marriage is now legal in all 50 states. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com. On the right, Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And our special guest is Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast. Welcome to all of you. So the Supreme Court is almost done with its current term, and we've had a number of big decisions. The court did not strike down a key aspect of the Affordable Care Act. It passed out a decision that gives the federal government broad power to enforce fair housing laws. But I think most of all, people are talking about a decision this morning that legalizes gay marriage. My colleague Adam Liptak wrote for The New York Times that this is shaping up to be one of the court's most liberal terms in decades, even though a majority of the court's members are Republican appointees. Kelly, I want to start with the gay marriage thing. And this is such a striking issue in terms of how fast it's moved. We have President Obama out there today celebrating this decision, even though 3 years ago, President Obama nominally did not even think gay marriage was good policy, let alone something that was required by the Constitution. How did we come so far so fast?
Well, it's interesting because I recently moved and I tend to be a bit of a hoarder, as some might say. So I actually came across a Newsweek from about 11 years ago, and the cover, it was after the sodomy decision had been just struck down in Texas. And the cover read, "Could marriage ever be next?" And of course, here we are, and it is a possibility. But at the time, it was written about sort of like a unicorn, you know, something that was just mythical and could possibly never happen. So we have kind of moved forward in lightning speed.
You know, Rich, there are four dissents in this decision. All four judges who dissented wrote their own dissenting opinion, sort of ranging from like only a little bit angry in John Roberts' opinion to really, really angry in Antonin Scalia's opinion. And Sam Alito was somewhere in the middle. And one of the things he talked about, he said that the ruling will, quote, be used to vilify Americans who are unwilling to assent to the new orthodoxy. And I think this is actually true. I think opposition to gay marriage is increasingly socially unacceptable and will become more so, and this opinion will be part of why. But I'm not clear on why I should care. There's no right to have people receive your political views politely. It feels almost like what you sometimes hear from the campus left about this, you know, this right to a safe space where people won't get mad at you about your political views. So why should we care if people aren't going to be nice to people who oppose gay marriage?
Well, I think it goes beyond not being nice. I mean, if you look back at that Indiana religious freedom debate where there was an effort by, I think it was CNN, to find some poor pizza shop owner who could say the wrong thing, so there could be this massive online attack on them.
Now, in fairness to CNN, I believe it was a local TV affiliate, but this did happen, okay, what you're describing.
Yes. And these poor people were bombarded with all this vilification online. Now, it had a happy ending because it attracted so much attention. You had conservatives going on to a Kickstarter campaign and donating them lots of money. But I do think, although Kennedy forswears that this will ever happen and the First Amendment will remain a bulwark in favor of people who hold traditional religious views on this matter, I think the momentum on this is so swift. I think the attitudes of a lot of the supporters themselves are so intolerant. We will see assaults on the rights of religious people who aren't on board this big social change.
Can I just say, though, I actually think that this is going to help conservatives because, as I've written before, the polls still show that almost half of Americans still oppose same-sex marriage. And so that's often forgotten because most people in media don't. I mean, that's just been my experience, regardless of which outlets I've worked at. Most people have, like myself, attended a number of same-sex weddings here in New York or in D.C. or wherever. And so that's kind of gotten forgotten. I think a lot of these people who are being silenced and know that publicly they may not be able to speak up might show their opinion at the ballot box. And I think that's something that the left needs to be wary of.
So, Bob, what do you think are the obligations of same-sex marriage supporters to their opponents? This is something that's talked about at some length in the majority opinion, that they're talking about protecting not just the rights, but sort of the dignity of people who are opposed to gay marriage. And the dissenters say that the majority opinion is incoherent about this, because if you follow the logic of the majority of opinion, which basically says that laws against same-sex marriage are disparaging to gays, it sort of follows that you ought to think negatively of the sort of people who would favor those laws.
Look, you know, it really goes to respect for the individual and human rights. I was once married by Orthodox rabbis, and I thought the whole exercise was quite primitive, and so did my wife, and who was escaping that background. And you could look at lots of religions, philosophical movements. You can think they're weird. You can think they're different. You can think it's not for you. But the basic question is this a matter of individual freedom to determine whether you want to be Orthodox Muslim or Jew or anything else or Christian, how you want to live, how long you want to leave your hair, what your prayer rituals and so forth. What the court said this time, and I don't think we should minimize this, this is an incredible decision, not just in terms of gay rights, but human rights. The court said that individual dignity, this was the majority opinion, individual dignity is critical. And I don't know how defense of individual dignity became a left issue. You know, you say safe space. I mean, everyone should have safe space to be themselves and to be different. That's the whole idea of limited government and the protection of individual rights. I'm willing as a person on the left to take credit for that, but it used to be a lot of conservatives who believed in safe space. And I don't know why we're assuming that, that people who want to extend human rights to gay people are intolerant and are going to persecute people. Where is the history of that? It's people who support gay rights that have been persecuted and killed. Remember Matthew Shepard? Remember, this is not ancient history. It was a crime to be a homosexual in California until Willie Brown got that law changed in the mid-70s, for God's sake. Remember the AIDS crisis when there were people arguing it was a good judgment of God to see all these people die because of their sexual preference. So the assumption that somehow people supporting an extension of human rights to gays are the source of intolerance in society, I think is a bit of madness. And I think the decision said very clearly what we're talking about is the right of the individual to define what is dignified behavior, what they want to do, what kind of relationships they want to have. And we should not be hemmed in by notions of religious intolerance.
I'm going to split the difference on this because, you know, like I said, I'm someone who has been to a number of same-sex weddings. I'll probably go to many more. I have plenty of people in my family who still oppose same-sex marriage. And in one instance, they actually sent a gift to my friends who were getting married. But they said, you know, the way that I biblically interpret biblical text, I don't believe you should be sleeping under my roof with someone you're not married to. And I don't believe two people of the same gender should be married. The reason I said I'm going to split the difference on this is because if we were to sit here on this show and talk about how people who practice Islam are misogynist, they are all misogynists because a number of women wear hijabs, that would be considered intolerant language. And yet if someone says, I believe gay people should have legal rights that should not be called marriage, they would be called intolerant. They would be called intolerant, and we would accept that. And so that's why I'm saying I split the difference, because the way we do speak about certain religious perspectives is different than how we speak about others. And I think that is probably what they were talking about in terms of language.
But I think there's more to life than formal legal equality. Like, if you think about, you know, some gay person and whether they are oppressed or not, like, you can be oppressed by a government, but you can also be oppressed by your own community or by your parents. And I think the broader social attitudes are important because, that, you know, for some kid growing up in Nebraska somewhere whose family is angry about the fact that he is gay or that she is a lesbian, like, what the Supreme Court says matters to some degree in terms of how it drives how society changes, but that's the main way it matters.
But that doesn't differ from what I just said, though.
Well, no, but I'm saying that, therefore, it's important to render judgments on an individual basis about other people's opinions about certain things.
But I think using the word intolerant is the point I'm getting at. I'm not disagreeing with anything you just said, but the family member I just described would agree with everything you just said, and yet they would still be called intolerant because they believe that gay couples should have domestic partnerships and it should not be called marriage. And based on the society we live in now, we are moving in the direction, like the Supreme Court said, where if that person were to say verbatim what I just said publicly, they would be shouted down as intolerant. And yet that's to me is odd.
Can I just say,
ahead,
I think
Bob,
this is a red herring. For goodness sake, I mean, the people who have been persecuted in this society have not been the people who wanted to be gay because they felt they were gay and they had rights. They were the people who shot them, killed them, beat them, excluded them, fired them. You can still be fired in a majority of states in this country for getting married. Even though the Supreme Court has said you have a legal right to be married, your boss can still fire you in 29 states. Let's get real here. You know,
which to me is a larger problem than marriage.
More important issue
than marriage, actually.
No, but because it's not a joking matter. The fact is that this is a very important statement by the Supreme Court. This is a historic statement. It will be studied forever, and it will change the general climate towards tolerance. What do we mean by individual freedom? This is the most important extension of the notion of individual freedom, because it says you can define your sexuality. It will extend to transgender, and it is very far-reaching. And it demolishes very primitive religious boundaries that have been used to stone people, you know, to exclude them, and not just religious people. Remember, we had secular societies like Nazi Germany, which also killed homosexuals as well as Jews.
With all due respect, America's killing very few people for being gay, but a lot of people being shot for being black right now.
I just think in terms of priorities. First of all, we have black gay people, too, who got double persecution. Right. I would point out to you the Civil Rights Movement's finest... moment, the March on Washington, was organized by a gay man, Bayard Rustin, who I knew very well, and he was persecuted most of his life more for being gay than for being black.
I don't think that's appropriate for you to make the deducement that he was persecuted.
I'm quoting him. I am quoting what Bayard Rustin said.
This doesn't need to be a competition.
I didn't bring that up. You're marginalizing
that,
a great. What President Obama said today was exactly correct. This issue has made more progress than comparable issues. That is unfortunate. The others have not made more progress. Yes.
Thank you for at least acknowledging that.
There's no question about it. And then
the irony of the two white males telling me not to make it a competition.
I'm telling Bob not to make it a competition.
To quote the Irish, the old Irish joke, is this a private fight or can I get into this too?
I would just make one
point, and this goes to the point you're making, Josh, and the point Bob was making as well. Changing the moral climate in the country around issues is not the role of the Supreme Court. It's the role of cultural figures. It's the role of politicians. And if you favor same-sex marriage, which I don't, that effort has been going swimmingly. So it's not the role of the Supreme Court to come in and end the discussion with this ruling on high that's very unconnected from the text of the Constitution or what the Supreme Court should be doing. So I object to the court's rulings on those grounds, and I think on those grounds it's really indefensible.
So in that vein, Rich, because I think including even in the way you talk about this and from supporters and opponents, there's a certain fatalism about this. People are talking about whether this was a good decision or a bad decision, but the effort, as you say, has been going swimmingly, and everyone expects this change to move in one direction. And that's put, I think, Republican presidential candidates in an awkward position where people are asking them, so what now? And we're seeing a variety of answers about what now. Jeb Bush has said he does not think that we should pursue a constitutional amendment on marriage. Scott Walker said today on Friday that we should do that. Mike Huckabee was insisting that the Congress and the president do not have to obey a Supreme Court decision that is not valid. So you're seeing a range of possible responses being put out there. How will Republicans address this issue on which everyone sort of seems to think they're inevitably losing?
Well, I favor in theory such a amendment as well, throwing it back to the states. But to pass a constitutional amendment in the United States of America, you need a supermajority on your side. You don't just need maybe a tentative 50% who still might not be fit in favor of gay marriage. So that's really a theoretical and abstract position. On Huckabee, I think maybe I know what he's getting at, although he's not necessarily expressing it very precisely, and maybe he's going too far. But you don't need to accept the Supreme Court's edicts as the last word of the Constitution. Every branch of government, every elected official has their responsibility on their own to defend the Constitution as they interpret it. And Lincoln did not accept the Dred Scott decision. He waged political warfare against it. Now, if that's what Huckabee means by disobeying, that's a completely solid point. If he means doing something like Andrew Jackson did, which is come after me, copper, I'm not going to pay any attention to what the Supreme Court is saying, that's a different matter.
Well, let us know what you think about the Supreme Court's decision on gay marriage at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, more on that, plus many other exciting decisions out of the Supreme Court this week. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel, stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, author of the new book, They Know Everything About You. Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, is on the right. And Kelly Goff of the Daily Beast is also with us. So it was a big week for the Supreme Court. It was also a big week for Chief Justice John Roberts, who is getting a lot of the credit slash blame for what the court is up to these days. And particularly, he wrote the majority opinion in King v. Burwell, which was the decision that did not strike down a portion of the Affordable Care Act. A lot of conservatives are unhappy with him. Donald Trump tweeted this morning, I think under the misimpression that Roberts had been in the majority on the gay marriage decision, saying, once again, the Bush-appointed Supreme Court Justice John Roberts has let us down. Rich, what do you make of the Roberts governance and this idea that the court has actually drifted somewhat to the left under him?
Well, I think Roberts is more, sadly, more an institutionalist than a constitutionalist, and the institution he cares most about is the Supreme Court and its reputation. And on these Obamacare cases, he just didn't want the court to be viciously criticized from the center left and the left. I can say really nasty things about his rulings. He doesn't care about me, but that's where the cultural power is, and that's what matters to him. And he has now three times gone out of his way, I believe, to rewrite provisions of the health care law in order to avoid striking parts of it down. Now, politically, if he had ruled what I think is if he and Kennedy had been on the right side of this and it had been a 5-4 decision interpreting the law as actually written, the political effect would have been not necessarily good for Republicans. It would have been chaotic. They probably would have ended up either temporarily extending these subsidies or depending on how it was going, permanently extending them. So I don't think this decision itself tells us much about whether the law will actually be entrenched forevermore or not, but it's another decision I object to on its merits.
I think John Roberts would disagree with that characterization of what John Roberts is up to. It's funny, actually, when you look at his majority opinion in King, the Affordable Care Act case, and his dissent in the gay marriage case, there's a common thread running through the two of them with Roberts painting himself as the anti-activist, basically saying, here, we just need to defer to the legislature. In King, he says, which is the healthcare case, in every case we must respect the role of the legislature and take care not to undo what it has done. And he says, Congress passed the Affordable Care Act to improve health insurance markets, not to destroy them. Then, of course, in his dissent in the gay marriage case, he talks extensively about how voters and state legislatures decided on this, and the court needs to defer to them. You know, Kelly, when people talk about judicial activism, I think they're mostly throwing it around just as a term of abuse and saying whatever decisions they don't like are activist decisions. But Roberts seems to have a theory of what's wrong with activism and how not to do it. And it took him to this unique place on these cases.
Well, I would just kind of follow up on something that Rich said, which is I think it's not just that he's focused on preserving the institution of the court, but also his own legacy. I think that there are really two firm possibilities here. It could turn out that he's a Sandra Day O'Connor, where they just kind of misread what type of justice this person would be when they put them on the court, or the possibility is that he's someone who's really concerned about his legacy. And in the same way there were justices, I mean, there was one whose name escapes me, but I know one of you knows, who had been a member of the Klan and ended up becoming one of the leading justices on civil rights during his tenure on the bench because he didn't want his legacy to read, I was a member of the Klan, but wanted it to stand for something greater. I do think that there's, the more you read Roberts' decisions, you can't help but think that this is someone who's looking ahead and not just about how his court was perceived, but about how he, a man and a jurist, was perceived. And I think that that's important to him, and we're seeing that.
Bob, what did you make of this decision in King? It really strikes me, the rhetoric around it, how both sides not only think that their reading of this law is correct, but that it is obviously correct, and that you kind of have to be an idiot to read the law the way the other side reads the law.
Well, first of all, on the justice that Kelly was referring to, Hugo Black, he actually was in the history that he had supposedly had some connection with the Klan. It was well understood when he was appointed that he was not going to go that way, and he turned out to be one of the principled defenders of civil liberty and civil rights that the court has ever seen.
Thank you for the name. I knew you would know it, Bob.
Well, I mean, history does matter here. But the fact is that in the case of Roberts, I don't think, first of all, I don't know why we're disparaging people. I disagree with Roberts on the gay marriage. I agree with him on some of his other decisions, certainly the Affordable Care Act, certainly on the surveillance state and attacking cell phone privacy and so forth. I think Roberts is a very interesting figure, but I don't think why we have to go to, you know, career motives or something. I think it's a pretty consistent core in his view. One could say, if you believe in states' rights and so forth, that the states are the incubator for profound social change. And then he does stress, you know, that change was happening in terms of gay marriage. And so he has what I think is a lame defense. But nonetheless, I think you could argue it's consistent with a states' right view. On the Affordable Care Act, I think it was just a question of common sense. Clearly, Congress indicated in many ways that it did not intend to put an excessive burden on conservative states that didn't have the federal exchange, and that they would underwrite the cost of subsidizing care for people who couldn't afford it. It's, from my point of view, the only actually decent, profoundly decent part of the Affordable Care Act. And the irony here is that those governors who would have been saddled by having to cut people off and have them, what, be in the emergency room because they couldn't get medical, they would have been left out there. So I think it was really a conservative reading of the language, which is, after all, what the Supreme Court is supposed to do, and the intention of Congress was clearly this was not some loophole for gutting the Affordable Act, but it was a confusion in a very small part of the language about who was going to pay for the subsidy. And it said, no, they could continue to subsidize it. So I don't see that as inconsistent. And I think where Roberts has been particularly strong is a notion of civil liberty as far as, comes up on the surveillance state. And I'm hoping he extends it to the CIA and the NSA. But I think his reading on the notion of limited government, his protection of the Fourth Amendment has been stellar. And I think the interesting thing about having a Roberts court is it sort of deprives the Hillary Clinton people of the automatic argument that if you don't vote for a Democrat, you'll end up with a Supreme Court that will be an absolute nightmare. Because, in fact, if it turns out the Roberts Court is not the worst thing in the world and has some bright spots, and right now we do see some bright spots, even when he's not in the majority, there's certainly room to take on important cases and make important decisions. I think it deprives the Democrats of that automatic lesser evil argument that has carried them through a lot of bad stuff.
I want to get to one more case that got a little less attention this week. It's a case called Texas Department of Housing, and it basically holds that the Fair Housing Act, a federal law on discrimination in housing, can apply to situations not just where a local or state government is doing something out of an attempt to discriminate racially, but when they have a policy that causes a disparate racial impact. In this case, it was the way Texas was allocating vouchers for affordable housing, sort of clustering them in already heavily minority neighborhoods, saying that even though Texas didn't have necessarily have a discriminatory intent there, the law still regulated it from the federal level. This was another 5-4 decision. Kelly, what did you make of this case?
Well, I think it's somewhat of a bright spot in because, you know, it's been an irony that under the first Black president, actually African-American civil rights issues in terms of this court have not progressed particularly well, particularly, I know you hate the competition, in comparison to some of the LGBT rights issues that have been before the court. And so this was somewhat of a bright spot, although if you actually look at the ruling, there are limitations that they placed on it, which are a bit too complex to get into because I can see by your face we don't have a ton of time left. But, you know, it's somewhat of a bright spot. I think that, you know, there's definitely... Look, I'm going to be honest. I'm concerned, you know, that the first Black president is heading towards the end of his administration and African Americans are actually not in as great of a place as any of us had hoped we, you know, our community would be when he started. So it's a bit of a mixed bag kind of for me in terms of how I'm feeling about the courts right now.
Rich, I know conservatives have generally been skeptical of desperate impact. Oh, you're holding up a sign that says raisins. did you want to talk about the Horn case, which is actually a case about raisins?
As an inside joke, the only conservative bright spot on the court recently was the Raisin decision, which is quite historic, and I would love to talk about it if I had had time to focus on it instead of being consumed with all these decisions I disagree with, including the disparate impact decision, which I think clearly goes beyond what Congress has stipulated in the law the standard should be in such cases, but I guess that just doesn't matter anymore.
And Rich knows I would make a great neighbor, so he's secretly psyched.
Well, we've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. And my rant this week actually is about that Raisin decision that Rich was referencing. This was a decision called Horn, and it was about a raisin farmer. There's a program that dates all the way back to the Depression where the government decides what's an appropriate amount of raisins to be produced in the U.S. And if raisin farmers produce too many, the government comes to them and says, give us your raisins so the price of raisins doesn't fall too much. The court ruled this week that that is in fact a taking. If the government comes to you and says, give me your raisins or else, they have to give you something in compensation for it. They found that they had not given them just compensation and struck the program down. It was a bright spot for conservatives in that it restricted the power of the federal government, and I think it was a restriction that was appropriate for the court to impose. Bob Scheer, your soapbox.
Yes, this is a great day for human rights as being indivisible and guaranteed to all. And I think of Melvin Cooper Smith, my childhood friend, who was routinely called Mel the Fag, even around the school. And he ended up committing suicide as an early young man after a life of being tormented and officially a torment that was officially condoned.
Rich Lowry, your soapbox.
I just want to hail the amazing Christian witness of the families of the victims of the Charleston shooting who, at a hearing, looked in the eye the sick, racist loser who had taken so much from them and forgave him, asked him to repent, and treated him with an extraordinary mercy. This was an astonishing exhibition, perhaps not surprising since Mother Emanuel is part of the Black tradition, church tradition in America, which is one of the glories of American civil society. These churches from the days of slavery have been an amazing symbol and vessel of hope.
Kelly Goff, what's on your mind?
I want to say amen and echo what Rich just said, but I also want to add that, you know, Pew released a survey not too long ago that found that the number of people who identify as Christians in this country is shrinking. And something I talked about in my upcoming column is it's not hard to see why when you see some of the hypocrisy and the hate and intolerance that tends to be identified with Christianity in the public space and in media. And so the one blessing that I'm really trying to find as a silver lining out of Charleston is that these nine people represent Christianity in such a profound way, as do their families, in displaying such forgiveness and kindness, as even their killer said they displayed to him before he chose to take their lives. The last part of my rant is I want to say to the media, we sometimes forget who the real stars of stories like these should be. And in this case, to me, it's not the man who took their lives, whose name I will not say on air, nor will I write it. It is the names of the nine victims whose name I want to say quickly: Cynthia Hurd, Susie Jackson, Ethel Lance, the Reverend DePayne Middleton Doctor, the Honorable Reverend Clementa Pinckney, Tawanza Sanders, Reverend Daniel Simmons, Reverend Sharonda Singleton, and Myra Thompson. They're the stars of the story we should be covering.
Thank you for that, Kelly. That is all we have time for today. I want to thank Robert Scheer, Rich Lowry, and Kelly Goff. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Sarah Singer Schiff is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.